Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Ashmore Group PLC results for the 6 months to the end of December 2020. My name is Mark Coombs. I'm the Chief Executive of the company, and also on the call with me, I have Tom Shippey, Group Finance Director, Paul Neasdale, Head of Investor Relations. We're going to take you through the numbers now. So first of all, starting on slide two in front of you, I hope, because it's in front of me, which is always good, is the overview of how we've been doing. Our financial performance for the 6 months reflects the typical early stages of a recovery cycle, really. Our AUM were up 11% over the 6 months to 93 billion, principally driven by good investment performance. We had lower average assets under management year-on-year from the previous period, down 6%, reflecting really where we are in the recovery cycle. Our adjusted EBITDA was down 12% year-on-year, in line with revenue. Margin was maintained at 68%, though. But despite the adjusted EBITDA being down, our strong seed capital returns in terms of our investments delivered growth in profit before tax of 14% to 150.6 million. So PBT up 14%. So decent financial performance for this stage is the early stage of a recovery cycle. In terms of other things that stand out for me, significant outperformance delivered in the period, 1, 3, and 5-year performance, dramatic improvement as a result. And the cycle is as usual. We think there's much more alpha to come. This is a typical recovery cycle from a crisis of last March. Our strategy continues to do what we want it to do. Equities AUM has grown 41% in the period to now over 6.5 billion, driven by strong performance and flow. Our investment-grade fixed income universe continues to grow with strong institutional demand and mutual fund products launched to pick up people interested in dollar-based yields in particular. Our ESG funds, the dedicated ones that we've established and seeded, are developing nice performance track records, going well. And our local asset management platforms, all part of that strategic diversification that we've always been looking for, are growing rapidly, a 39% increase in assets under management over the 6-month period. So basically, the outlook, we think, continues to favor EM. The critical thing, of course, is vaccination programs that work, and so they're critical to worldwide recovery in 2021. As that rolls out, we think the world does better steadily. Developed markets have had massive stimulus. And as that short-term support wears off, we think capital will do what it usually does in that situation, look for higher growth and returns elsewhere. And economic growth forecasts and relative valuations continue to favor emerging markets over developed markets. So that's the overview. In terms of the detail of the strategy, let's just pick up on the key points. Our operating model is still doing well. We're delivering alpha as we should do at this time in the cycle. Our business model continues to be robust and flexible in terms of managing our cost base, and it's adapted well. And then the three key points that we've seen very nice progress in the half. Equities momentum, as I mentioned before, up 41%. All cap, which is our second global emerging market equity strategy, has now achieved a 3-year track record. And if you look to the right on this screen, under the first box, global emerging market equity strategies, you can see 3-year numbers where we now have them also for active, for all cap as well as for active. And so our two global emerging market equity strategies are now beating their benchmarks, active over 3 years by 240 basis points, and that now has a much longer track record, and all cap by 700 basis points. Meanwhile, small cap continues to do well as part of the all cap team at 760 basis points. So very strong equity outperformance over 3-year period. Meanwhile, in investment grade fixed income, 3-year numbers again strong. These bonds that are investment grade in emerging economies now make up more than 50% of all dollar external and corporate debt indices. So investment grade is the bulk of the issuance within the space. We have good performance, and institutional demand is steadily increasing. Less vol, strong macros, particularly against developed markets, higher yields, and of course, no defaults in investment grade. So in the sovereign space, we have 70 basis points of alpha over 3 years. In the corporate space, we have 160. So strong investment grade performance in fixed income is attracting capital. And then finally, ESG, which, as you know, we've always cared about because, frankly, when you're investing in emerging economies, governance was the first thing we worried about way back 20-odd years ago. And now we have dedicated ESG funds. both a fixed income one in blended debt and an equity one. And as you can see, what we do there is we generate significant alpha too. So in the blended debt space, we have 120 basis points of alpha over the benchmark since inception, which is now 2 years for the dedicated funds. And then in equities, we have a huge amount of alpha since March inception. It just happened to be that we launched it at the bottom of the market, which always helps. But still, 2,000, a lot. 26% of alpha is a seriously good number. So good, I can hardly get my head around it, but I just managed it. So we have a broad range of product. We have people beginning to look at it. We also, in terms of sustainability, we integrate the way we think about it, not only underpinning all that we do, but these dedicated funds producing good numbers. And our foundation, our charitable foundation, which gives back to emerging economies, is it continues to grant to projects which help offset our emissions and get us to where we want to be in terms of ESG as a company. And then finally, as part of this whole diversification of assets under management and revenue story, local markets are growing significantly. So our scalable platforms now are doing nicely, nearly 20% in 2020 in terms of growth in assets, despite the March shock, and over 39% in the last 6 months. Next slide, please, Paul. Investment performance, just to sum where that fits, because I think that's a good, if you like, a leader in terms of what happens in terms of client activity. Over the 1 year, the group is now 50% outperforming. After the shock in March, we were down to 9% outperforming over 1 year, but now 50% of liquid securities are now outperforming. As you can see, strong in local and corporate across the piece, weaker in external and blended, and in equities, a mixture of strong local story and not so strong in global, driven particularly by one of the larger themes, which was just underperforming its benchmark, which actually isn't now. Reflecting into 3 years, which is obviously critical, we're up from 17% outperforming over the period to 39%. And as you can see, very strong global equity outperformance, which is what which I've picked up on the previous slide and is what people particularly focus on. So despite the hit in fixed income in March 20 and in equity to an extent, global equity has performing very strongly. Over 85% of our accounts are now outperforming over 3 years. And in the fixed income space, we're now up over 60% in local, over 50% in corporate, and continue to move in the right direction. And what does that do over the 5 year? At June 20, we were 74% outperforming. Now we're up to 91%. So performance is doing what we would expect it to do at this point in the cycle. And we're happy with performance. And this is something that we feel very comfortable that clients can be discussed with happily and that we can sell. So over the last 6 months, that number actually raises to 97%, but it should be at this time in the cycle. This is exactly what we would expect. So things are happening as we would hope. Next slide, please, Paul. One thing that people often ask us about in the fixed income space is our blended debt strategy, which mixes external, local and corporate risk. And how that performs, and so what we've done is we show people how our performance works over the cycles, and what we've done on the right is produce a graph which gives you, if you like, three events. One is the global financial crisis of 2008-09, which is the gray line. The second is the U.S. rate hike panic 2014-16, and the third is the COVID, which is the dark blue line that runs out just over halfway across the page. And what this really reflects is how our blended debt strategy performs after market drawdown, significant crises. It lags straight away. We then get very active. Well, not that we're not always active, but we get a big opportunity in a crisis to be very active. What happens is the markets go through an initial recovery phase where, you know, first of all, high beta was oversold dramatically as people reprice. Economic conditions then tend to improve and asset prices recover. And if you look at where we are now, first phase in terms of recovery has been there. The second phase is now cutting in. And of course, the shape of that recovery will depend on COVID-19, the way things are going. But if you just look on the right graph again, and in the table below it, if you look, our drawdown in COVID-19 was nearly 9%. It was 7% and a bit and 4% in the global financial crisis and the rate hikes as well. 9 months out, we've achieved 12.5% worth of alpha against 11.8 in the global financial crisis and 10.3 in US rate hikes. 3 months later, those numbers have gone up to 15 and 13, and 2 years later, 24 and 17. We don't have, you know, past performance is not necessarily a guide to future performance, but time and time again, it has been with us. So we would see this trend continuing for a good 12 to 15 months in terms of further outperformance. And as you can see on the graph, that looks relatively reasonable, and let's hope we achieve it. But we think there's every reason we should. There's nothing to suggest that we won't get the same story as we've had before. Next slide, please, Paul.
Thanks, Mark. So the high-level summary of Ashmore's financial performance over the 6 months and consistent with the early stage of a market recovery is that strong investment performance across the group's themes has delivered AUM growth, meaningful gains on seed capital investments, and therefore a sharp rise in pre-tax profit year on year. However, the natural cyclical lag in terms of average asset levels and therefore revenues means that adjusted EBITDA is lower than in the prior year period. Moving into the detail, assets under management increased by 11% to $93 billion over the 6 months, driven by strong investment performance. However, the initial negative impact of COVID-19 on market levels in early 2020 means that average AUM was 6% lower than in the 6 months to December 19, and the knock-on effect on net management fee income means adjusted net revenues declined 12% year on year. Ashmore's flexible operating model, coupled with a relentless focus on controlling costs, means that adjusted operating costs were reduced by 9% compared with the prior year, delivering adjusted EBITDA of £107.2 million, and meaning that the group maintained its high operating margin at 68%. The combination of higher market levels and the significant outperformance that Mark described resulted in very strong gains on seed capital, totaling £49.3 million for the period, and consequently profit before tax increased 14% to £150.6 million, and diluted EPS was 15% higher at 18.2 pence per share, with the group benefiting from a lower effective tax rate of 14.7%. Therefore, balancing operational performance with the statutory results, at the interim stage, the board has maintained the dividend at the prior year level of 4.8 pence per share. As Mark showed, investment performance was strong across all investment themes in the period and added nearly $11 billion to assets under management. Gross subscriptions of $7.5 billion, or 9% of AUM, were lower than in the prior year period, but reflected consistent trends. Importantly, the group's distribution model has adapted to the remote working environment that continues in many regions globally, and through existing strong relationships, together with the ability to develop new ones, has delivered a diversified mix of new mandate wins and meaningful additions to existing mandates. Of note has been the growing demand for investment-grade product, particularly in external debt, and continued subscriptions into global equities products, meaning that equities have now delivered consecutive net inflow quarters since mid-2019. Redemptions of $8.9 billion were comparable to the prior year period and reflect a range of independent decisions with no overriding pattern. Asset allocation-based decisions added to redemptions from blended debt and local currency, and there were mutual fund outflows in the local currency and corporate debt themes. Approximately 40% of the gross redemptions were from the intermediary channel, and while this was a similar level of churn to the prior year period, it's understandably higher than the approximate 10% share of AUM that these clients represent. On a net basis, outflows of $1.4 billion improved from the $5.8 billion outflow in the preceding 6 months, and comprised $2 billion redeemed by intermediary clients, offset by $0.8 billion of net institutional inflows, while $0.2 billion was returned to investors from the alternatives theme following successful asset realizations. In summary, asset development over the past 6 months is consistent with Ashmore's experience of previous recovery cycles following a period of market stress, with outperformance initially driving asset growth and the net flow picture improving, albeit with a lag. Now, before I get into the detail of the financial results, I thought it'd be useful to highlight the increasing contribution of Ashmore's local investment management platforms. As a reminder, these businesses have been established to exploit the significant domestic EM growth opportunity as GDP per capita increases and independent asset management industries develop and become more sophisticated. In addition to asset and profit growth, they also diversify the group's investment management capabilities, recurring management fee income, and client base. Together, these businesses grew assets by nearly 40% over the six-month period and today manage approximately $7 billion. Individually, the businesses in Colombia, India, Indonesia, and Saudi Arabia each manage in excess of $1 billion. And it's particularly pleasing that following its IPO a year ago, Ashmore Indonesia has continued to grow strongly, increasing its assets by 20% to almost $3 billion. It's also encouraging that in addition to raising capital from local investors, a number of these platforms have attracted mandates from the group's global institutional client base, where the client is seeking specific country or regional exposure. Ashmore will continue to develop and support these businesses as they become a more meaningful part of the group's activities and will seek further opportunities to expand the network where possible. While adjusted net revenues for the period were 12% lower year on year, the main components of management fees, performance fees, and FX-related items developed differently, reflecting the specific point in the recovery cycle. It's therefore maybe worthwhile spending some time going through the detail here. Net management fee income declined by 17%, with approximately half of the movement the result of the 6% lower average AUM level and the headwind of stronger sterling against the US dollar compared with the prior year period. The change in the group's average net management fee margin from 46 to 42 basis points accounts for the rest of the move and is primarily due to the impact of changes in client type and product mix. Looking at the 4 basis point move, net outflows from higher margin mutual funds in the local currency and corporate debt theme account for 1.5 basis points. Investment theme mix effects, notably the growth in overlay AUM, albeit partially offset by continued growth in the equities theme, explains another basis point. And a further basis point is the consequence of decent growth in large institutional mandates, both winning new clients and additional allocations to existing funds. This leaves around half a basis point that is not directly attributable to these factors and represents the impact of sub-theme mix, for example, the growth in investment grade product within the external debt theme, as well as competitive margin pressure in keeping with our long-run expectations. My guidance, therefore, continues to be for these competitive effects to reduce the revenue margin by approximately a basis point or so every 12 to 24 months, but with the usual caveat that other factors may impact the reported margin, as we've seen again in this period. Turning now to performance fee income, the group delivered £7.7 million, more than twice the level of the prior year and higher than estimated at the full year results in September. Additional fees were earned by funds with measurement dates between October and December, with performance fee generation benefiting from the ongoing market rally, Ashmore's significant alpha generation, as well as the realizations in alternatives. In terms of full year guidance, given there are fewer funds with performance fee measurement dates in the second half, it's reasonable to assume that the historic rule of thumb holds, meaning approximately 2/3 of annual performance fee income is delivered in the first half. Therefore, full year performance fee income is likely to be no higher than £11 million. Finally, the group generated £8.7 million of foreign exchange gains in the period through the implementation of an effective hedging policy and the timing of foreign currency cash flows during the period. This more than offset the £6.1 million of balance sheet FX translation losses, which were broadly in line with the sensitivity given in September, and which we removed from the presentation of adjusted revenues. Turning now to operating costs, it shows a familiar picture of continued discipline cost control, and which means that adjusted operating costs were reduced by 9% year on year. Dealing first with staff costs, the broadly stable headcount and relatively low salary cap for group employees means that fixed staff costs of £13.6 million was unchanged compared with the prior year period. The variable bonus expense has been accrued as usual at 20% of pre-tax profit at the half year stage, and therefore, given lower reported revenues, this charge fell by 16% year on year. Other operating costs of £9.6 million were reduced by 13%, or £1.4 million, primarily as a result of continuing restrictions relating to travel and office use in most of the group's locations, but also reflecting the ongoing strict control of all elements of the group's operating cost base. While the path of COVID-19 and the related restrictions remains uncertain, we continue to believe that Ashmore's business model and culture lend themselves to employees working collaboratively in close-knit teams in an office environment. I therefore consider some of these cost reductions to be temporary in nature, and when government guidance permits, Ashmore will return to its offices globally and recommence business travel. For the immediate future, this still seems unlikely, and therefore the first half run rate for non-VC costs is representative of the likely level for the second half. Another consistent feature of Ashmore's business model is its active seed capital programme, which has delivered tangible benefits in terms of AUM, with 10% of the group's assets being developed from seeded product. In this reporting period, the group's investments also delivered a meaningful profit contribution with a total pre-tax gain of £49.3 million, of which 3.3 million was realized. The investment gain reflects the balance of investments by theme, with just over half delivered by the equity funds and nearly 30% by funds in the alternatives theme. The balance was broadly spread across fixed income and multi-asset product. New seed investments made in the half totaled £68 million and included investment grade product in the corporate debt theme, reflecting the growing demand for this asset class and in support of distribution initiatives, including seeding funds for a new third party distribution channel in Latin America and providing incremental scale to existing equity product. Successful realizations of nearly £80 million was achieved, mainly in the equities theme, as funds reach scale and attract client flow, thereby enabling the group to redeem its investment profitably and as a result of alternatives funds realizing assets and subsequently returning capital to investors. Despite the net recycling of investments to cash over the 6 months, strong performance means the value of seed capital book increased and, including undrawn commitments, is now approximately £265 million. New investment strategies or distribution channels continue to be identified in support of the group's growth, and therefore I'd expect the overall size of the programme to remain in the broad range of £250 to £300 million, subject to market movements and recycling opportunities. To complete the P&L picture, statutory profit before tax increased by 14% to £150.6 million, driven by strong seed capital gains. The effective tax rate of 14.7% was lower than the 16.5% implied by the geographic mix of the group's profits. The benefit in the period derives from certain of the seed capital profits being non-taxable until realised, and the impact of the increase of the group's share price on the allowable value of equity awards made to employees. The composition of the group's profitability has not changed materially, and so I continue to expect the ongoing underlying tax rate to be in the range 16 to 17%. On a statutory basis, diluted EPS increased by 15% to 18.2 pence. However, after adjusting for FX translation and seed capital items, diluted EPS reduced by 13% to 12.8 pence per share. The board has declared an undeclared interim dividend of 4.8 pence per share, balancing the strong mark-to-market profit contribution from seed investments with the operational performance given the stage of the recovery cycle. Looking now at the cash flow, the group continues to generate significant operating cash of £89.2 million in the period, with active recycling of seed investments generating an additional £35.9 million in cash over the 6 months. Ashmore's cash uses remain consistent, being paying tax, distributing ordinary dividends to shareholders, and purchasing shares into the group's employee benefit trust. Ashmore's cash balance typically reduces in the first half, given the payment of cash variable compensation to employees and the distribution of the final dividend in respect of the prior financial year. Additionally, the strength of sterling over the 6 months had a mark-to-market translation impact on the value of cash held in foreign currencies, both here in the UK and in the overseas operations, which therefore meant that in aggregate, the group's reported cash balance reduced by approximately £50 million over the period to £441 million in total. And finally, from me on the balance sheet, a brief update. The group's balance sheet remains reassuringly well capitalised and liquid, and our philosophy is to maintain a strong balance sheet throughout the cycle. Looking back over the past year, the strength and integrity of the balance sheet has once again served Ashmore, its clients and shareholders well, for example, by facilitating continued investment and growth opportunities through the seed capital programme. As this page shows, the group's capital position continues to be robust, with no debt and significant resources in excess of the Pillar 2 regulatory requirement, equivalent to approximately 81 pence per share. The balance sheet is also highly liquid, with £441 million of cash and approximately 75% or £194 million of the seed capital investments in funds with at least monthly dealing frequency. So with that, I'll hand you back to Mark to say a few words on outlook.
Thanks, Tom. Thank you very much. So outlook is reasonable from here. I mean, obviously the key driver of everything is at this stage is COVID vaccination, seems to me. Worldwide process socially and economically is going to progress, is going to require widespread vaccination. And happily that's in train, and how long it takes, how effective it is, and the rollout of that is going to be the key to 21. Having said that, I then look at where we go in that and where the best place to be is. And I feel, if anything, emerging markets is more favored than ever over developed markets. If you look at the graph on the right, you're looking at EM growth rates in light blue and in gray DM growth rates. 20 obviously had a pretty big hit for everybody, smaller hit for EM. And going forward from here, we would see stronger growth coming out of it for EM than for DM. Massive stimulus is fine, and we've seen that particularly with developed world governments, central banks. A US election result that some thought enjoyed, some didn't. Pretty supportive for markets in the near term, but medium term impact on growth from that kind of stimulus potentially is the currency devaluation in the US dollar. And that again favors EM coming from here. As you know, we've talked about this many times, but they have lower debt to GDP. They also have higher real interest rates and have been able in this cycle to do some monetary and fiscal stimulus, which is manageable compared to what happens in developed markets and where the numbers are really pretty high. Growth premium is there. Fixed income and equity markets are attractive valuations, particularly relative to developed markets. So both of our major liquid themes, we think, have an advantage over developed market themes of fixed income and equity. And we think it's supportive of capital flow. So as investors look for higher returns, even as simple things as yields in dollars into the fixed income space, but also higher equity returns, given better growth rates and starting from lower bases, we're very well positioned to benefit from this. We're pleased with the shape of the business. It can always do better. We always love to do better, but we feel we're in a pretty good place this stage in the cycle. So to sort of summarize, I've kind of covered this a little bit, but I guess that's the point of a summary. I should repeat myself once again. But hopefully in a way that really gives you the nub of what we think. We're financially, as a company, both where we should be at this stage of recovery in markets. We've had a very strong return from what we've done in terms of seed, as you would expect, having taken a hit before, but a much bigger return from the upside, because that's what we do well in terms of investing. Our investment outperformance over this period has been very strong, as it should be. As a strategy, the things that we're trying to do to diversify our business are paying off, and paying off at a decent rate, both in terms of equities, local markets, building out the ESG book. And we believe investors will look for higher growth and returns and will favor EM over DM. So we think we're in a place where we're in pretty good shape, and we're looking forward to a good year. At this point, I think I'm going to throw it open for questions and look forward to hearing them. Or seeing them, depending on what they are.
First of all, we have some questions from Hayley Tam. The 9 month performance to December is very clear and strong, but how has performance developed since the end of December?
Shall I take that one? I think January was a pretty weak month for markets generally. February's been pretty good. So, but it's, you know, obviously you look at market numbers and there's some read through to what we do, but we're pretty comfortable with what we're doing in terms of alpha.
And then, is Ashmore seeing higher volumes of clients interested in investing in EM debt in 2021 versus the second half of 2020? And related to that, what does Ashmore believe is its differentiated edge to win fund flows? Is it performance, longevity of activities, fees, or something else?
This was a debt-specific question. What normally happens after a crisis is you get knee-jerk activity. Firstly, by retail, principally in terms of nervousness and fear. You then get people, and you get some positive institutional activity for those who understand process and I got more comfortable with acquiring risk in a difficult period. But it tends to be lower activity after that for a little period as people absorb where they're at, decide what they want to do and asset allocate. Activity tends to pick up 12 to 18 months after a crisis, but not in a straight line like that, but in a steadily increasing line in terms of net flow. And if you look at the way we've been reporting what's happened, this is extremely typical. This is exactly like all the other major crises we've had in terms of flow patterns. How will we do as flows recover, both in debt and equity? I think we'll do relatively well based on clients always like performance. They also like relationship and consistency of performance, understanding what that does. So I think there are certain products that produce certain risk return profiles that we are consistent in that. And I think people will be attracted to that. So performance and consistency of it over a long period of time is valuable. And I think that's if you like what we're offering people. We stick to our knitting, both in fixed income and in equity, and we're doing what we say we do on the tin. There are higher risk products and lower risk products. They're all in a very strong performance shape at the minute, which is good.
What ambitions does Ashmore have for equities as a proportion of AUM and local capital as a proportion of AUM? And what benefit to group EBITDA margin would a doubling of those assets under management in each area give?
Let me take the first part of that. These are going to be slightly general answers. I mean, the reason we have decided long ago, that we wanted to be not just in the fixed income space, but in the equity space and the alternative space in EM, is we believe there are certain things that underline emerging market knowledge and analysis that we offer as a company to each other, and therefore we can offer to clients. We didn't sit down one day and say, you know what, we should be 50% fixed income, 50% equity, and zero alternatives, or a third, a third, a third. Or what we believe is that as long as we can perform and we're good in the space, and I think we demonstrably are proving that now in all of the things that we do, and we try and improve it all the time, but we've had a particularly strong recent performance in some of the newer things that we do. We think assets will come as they should. I mean, it's not just about asset accretion. Obviously, the most important thing is that we perform and assets come and we continue to perform. So we think that we continue to grow at a sensible speed. Equity starting from a lower percentage, you would expect to become a larger percentage over time. And that would be great. We'd like to have a balanced book of business. Would we want to be 100% fixed income? No. That's why we started in equities. Would we want to be 100% equity? No. That's why we had a fixed income book. So I would see certainly equities rising as a percentage naturally, although, of course, that can be slowed down from time to time for good reasons when you get significant flow from your existing client base. We want to stay good at fixed income and continue to be good at equity, and we think business will flow to us. In terms of margin, have you got any rough numbers you want to throw out?
Broadly, as a group, the local platforms are delivering around about 50% operating margin across the network. So there's a bit of a drag to the group's overall margin as a consequence. It's probably no more than a percentage point or two. But the good news is that 50% is expanding as each of the local platforms continues to grow and deliver scale. So I don't know whether it would be within a doubling of assets, but I would have thought by the time that the local platforms in aggregate got to three times the size, so sort of 20 billion or so in total, that aggregate margin of 50% should be approaching the group's margin of high 60s or so. So therefore closing the gap. And boosting the overall group margin.
Yeah, they tend to be wider margins than what we're doing in basic fixed income, as does equities, all of which is margin enhancing, which we're looking for, of course.
Okay, given the strong recent fund performance, where does Ashmore expect the variable remuneration percentage to settle for the full year?
Well, as you know, we put a straw man in place of 20% as a reasonable number at this time. We'll see how the performance is. I mean, obviously, better performance tends to increase the percentage, worse performance tends to reduce it. We'll see how things run. Too early to say.
And then from Gurjit Kamba at JP Morgan, what is the exit run rate on net management fee margins coming into the current calendar year?
Tom?
It's not wildly different, actually, to the 42 basis points. It's a touch lower because some of the mix effects and the large mandates funded towards the back end of the first half. So there's a bit of sort of full period effect of mix and size to come through. But the current run rate margin is only about half a basis point or so off from the average for the half.
And if there are any client mandates at risk in the current quarter, given performance pictures, what might that suggest in terms of net inflows or outflows in the current quarter?
Well, I think stepping back, the way we look at flow is exactly the same in this cycle as in any other. And the good news is you've got a lot of historical data in terms of how our flow profile has been. As I mentioned earlier, what tends to happen is you get a bit of knee-jerk reaction, then a bit of inactivity, then you get a bit more reaction, and then you turn to net inflow. That typically happens over 12 months after a crisis, to be honest. I think we're exactly where we'd expect to be. So we're, where are we now? We're kind of nearing 12 months. So we're getting the pattern we would expect. It really depends. Obviously, we would particularly like to see where we are come the full year. That will tell us exactly where we're at and whether this cycle is indeed like all the others. So far, it's exactly like the others, with some nuances here and there, but it's the flow pattern we would expect.
From Mike Werner at UBS, what is the quantum of temporary cost savings that you've achieved through not traveling, for example, in the first half of this financial year? And secondly, given the gains in the alternatives market on the seed capital book, are there any new alternative funds in the pipeline?
Do you want to take the first one of those, Tom? I think you covered it. Just re-emphasize.
Yeah. So on the operational cost, so it's probably about £500,000, something like that, in aggregate through not traveling and saving some money by running the office network more effectively or efficiently while it's not open. So I hope we can repeat that sort of through the remaining period. Although, as I said, yeah, we're keen to get people back into offices when we're allowed to. We think that will, you know, be a big benefit to us once we can do that. In terms of the alternatives product, we've got a number of products in the market at the moment, notably in our Latin America infrastructure business. So we're fundraising in Colombia, both on the private equity side and subsequently on the credit side. So we will be rolling some GP commitments into those funds once they close, hopefully later this half.
Yeah, and also fundraising in the real estate space, which has been a nice performer too. So we're expecting to continue to do what we do. Other opportunity comes up as we find people and areas that interest us. So we're not in any way not continuing to do what we do in alternatives, but we pick our spots because we try and make sure that we're successful at it. We have nice businesses that continue to perform for clients and give us opportunities to make money over the cycle.
There's two questions from Bruce Hamilton at Morgan Stanley. Has there been any change in the FX sensitivity? And secondly, how do you think about client interest in the EM asset classes if inflations and or rates in the US surprise to the upside?
Do you want to take the first one, Tom?
Yeah, so no, the FX sensitivity is pretty similar to that we gave at the half year point. So it's about £4 million for a 5 cent move.
Yeah, in terms of the second question, it depends on the degree, usually. Big inflationary shock can be a dramatic impact for all markets, as I remember from 94, those of us who are alive. Remember from 94, it was a huge, huge, nasty shock in US rate markets when the market really didn't expect hikes. But assuming that the world central bankers, and including the Lady Yellen, who's now back involved, have kind of learned a little bit from that, they'll try very hard not to be dramatic shocks. Generally, higher inflation in DM is going to help what we try and do in EM. Shocks will give us an immediate jump. All markets will be nervous. But again, look at 94. That gives us massive outperformance opportunities in EM because everything correlates to one in a little crisis, and an inflationary shock would be a crisis if it was a real shock and things weren't forecast and managed. But then coming out of the crisis, we would outperform as we usually do.
There's some flows related questions from Hubert Lam at BAML. Why do you think your flows have lagged the broader industry, which I think is a reference to mutual fund flows? Do you expect the mix of demand toward more investment grade product to continue? And where you've had outflows from retail, do you expect this to continue or to stabilize given your positive outlook?
In terms of our flows in the industry, I'll take your word for it if you say that we've been lagging them. I think it really depends by theme and sub-theme. So be it blended debt or investment grade corporate debt, depending upon what it is, I think we've seen pretty strong flow in various sub-themes. In terms of where we see from here, obviously, as what tends to happen, as I said, in the cycle, is you get more interest, particularly from retail, coming in after a period of time. When we expect to see a decent share of those flows. What was the third part of the question? Sorry.
Specifically on investment grade demand, do you expect that to continue?
Yeah, that was a, in many ways, the best part of the question. Not that they weren't all brilliant. Yes, I do. The reason I do is that I think that generally investors have got a problem, which is, where do I go to make money? Capital gains, okay, I guess I should go to equity, but whoa, DM equities have been, you know, have been on a bit of a tear. So if I like relative value equities, I've got to go to EM. So, okay, that's good for the equity platform. I mean, even in January, which I think the lady before said, how about January performance? You know, fixed income had a bit of a hit generally across the place, but equities has had an adjustment, but it's been in pretty very good shape. So people have got to work out where they're going to go. And so and other than capital gain, the other thing people like is yield to pay the bills every day by the milk. And if you don't want to take currency risk, that puts you in dollars, and that puts you in what? So the answer is investment grade, and then you've got to look at where the value is in investment grade, and it's in what we do. Both you can get pick up in sovereign investment grade, but also in corporate investment grade, very nice pick up over what's available in the US and the other developed world markets. And so I do expect to see further investment grade as appetite. We see steady inquiry in that space, and that's great. We're happy that, as I say, increasing percentage of what we do in fixed income is investment grade anyway, because that's how those markets are trending.
Three questions from Chris Turner at Berenberg, all different areas. So the first question, Ashmore's entrepreneurial culture has been a large part of its strength over the years. A key contributor to that has been the flexible compensation model. Now, all three proxy advisors appear to have an issue with this, encouraging shareholders to vote against Ashmore's remuneration policy. How problematic is this, and do you see it as a threat to your culture? And if so, what might the remedy be?
That's only one question. Okay, we'll deal with them one at a time. Let me kick off, and Tom, if you want to add anything, please do. I think all we can do is point. I mean, and there are different people to talk to here. There are different audiences. So all we can do is do what we think is the best thing in terms of maintaining what's made us what we are today. I mean, one can argue about how successful we could always be more successful, but we have a business. And we built it over many years. And that has been driven by culture. And not all of it, but a large part of that has been driven by everybody feeling they're an equity owner in the business, and it's because they are. And that's great. And we continue to want to do that. And we built a culture based on a comp structure that, as you know, that control cost. And there's good reasons to do that. When you get a crisis, you know, tend to fire everybody because you don't need to, because you're built to run the business for the long term, not for the short term. And also the people will be around for a long time, which again, we've touched wood, he said, clutching the desk, been able to have happen for a long time. We like people staying for the long term. And we do what we think is the right thing to do that. Now, we do get caught up in some of the issues that various advisors have through abuses of certain elements of compensation structure, none of which we've been guilty of and will continue not to be, because why would we? We're interested in long-term equity value. We'd be nuts if we weren't. We're all shareholders. It's kind of stupid. It can be noise. It can be an irritant sometimes. People say, "Oh, I saw in the papers today for whatever reason, you know, people were nervous about this, that, and the other." And so, all we can do is continue to maintain our culture and our comp structure. We can discuss with shareholders and any other stakeholders the why we do it. The frustrating thing for us is sometimes that the people in the shareholder who like to own the shares buy more shares because of the culture. And the people who are in the shareholders who are compliance officers say, well, you can't buy them, but they still manage to do it. But the compliance officers make the headline for not ticking the right box. Whereas the shareholders love what we do, the people who actually make the investment decisions. And they say, well, I wish our comp structure was like yours because it's flexible to bad markets, because it doesn't embed ridiculously high levels of costs. So all we can continue to do, he said, maintaining a calm and measured approach, is explain our comp structure to everybody, to our shareholders, to future stakeholders, other shareholders, employees, and to the world in general, to explain why we think it's the right thing to do. But of course, we need to listen to what happens in the world. We need to think about things that do matter to the wider market. And if things reach a point where we think they're negative or damaging to the business and to shareholders, we have to reflect on that and make adjustments, which we've done over the years. We've added performance tests for people like myself and Tom. We've done all that kind of thing when we've been happy to do it. So where there are good adjustments that come through, we're happy to take them. And so we'll continue to try and maintain our culture whilst being aware of the wider market and not doing anything that would hurt shareholders or clients. in terms of increasing employee turnover or anything that we think would be negative. So we've got to keep an open mind, but we do believe very strongly in our culture, which is we try not to hire and fire people like crazy. We try and have people be long-term owners, and we as a result, control our fixed cost base. And we're all in this for the really long term, and for the shareholders as a group, and clients as a group, and all stakeholders. So we want stability, we listen, but we're not going to knee-jerk change things, and we will continue to explain why we do it, and we'll adjust as we think it makes sense. Very long answer to the first of hopefully two shorter questions to follow. Shorter answers.
We can combine them. They relate to the third phase of the strategy and gathering assets from EM investors. Can you give us an update on where we are with this phase of the strategy? And specifically, could we have a little more detail on the product that you are seeding for the third-party distributor in Latin America?
Yes. Tom, do you want to take the first bit of that? I've just kind of waffled for a while.
Yep, sure. So some of the specifics, Chris, are in the presentation. So that the local platforms themselves now managing around $7 billion directly. And then the total amount of capital that we manage that is sourced from EM clients is around 26%. So it's been broadly consistent over the last few periods. Yeah, we tend to sort of ebb and flow a little bit between the high 20s and low 30s. But over the last couple of years, it's been somewhere around about the 30% level.
And the second part of the question, what we're looking to do always when we're looking for distribution is a broad base of products. So we've been involved in seeding both fixed income and equity. So global equity and I think it blended. No, actually, it was an external debt, I think, fixed income product, but offering both.
There are no more further questions.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Once again, delightful to not see you, so to speak, but I'm hoping next time we do see you. Thank you very much for your attention and for showing up, so to speak. We once again have enjoyed talking to you, albeit not physically hearing you, but we've heard you through the Mighty Me's Day, which is an entertainment in itself. We've had a decent start to this period, and we're looking forward to continuing that. And we appreciate your interest in what we do, and we appreciate any shareholders who are watching, thank you for watching. And we very much appreciate all clients for doing business with us. And we hope to continue to do that for many years with all of you. Thank you very much. On that note, I think we'll sign off.